Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 132 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling The Wicked Problem of Herbicide Weed Resistance. The second half of my conversation with WSU weed scientist Ian Burke and Drew Lyon, who holds the Washington Grain Commission Endowed Chair in Small Grains Extension and Research, Weed Science. Hopefully, you've listened to the first half of our conversation, which focused on various issues surrounding the chemical glyphosate, better known by its brand name, Roundup. In this episode, the three of us talk more generally about weed resistance issues and what that challenge means for the future. I first interviewed Lyon about resistance issues facing Northwest farmers in episode 46, which I entitled, The Challenge That Will Not Wait. That episode posted more than 18 months ago, and the resistant weed drumbeat has only grown louder. You can find episode 46 on the Washington Grain Commission website at wagrains.org. Click on Summaries and navigate back into time. My opinion of weeds is that they are tough enough to control without throwing chemical resistance into the mix. About a dozen years ago, I planted wheat on a 4-foot-wide bench against a slope along the side of my Spokane yard. I had a beautiful crop that first year and got many questions from neighbors asking about the strange but lovely plant I was growing. I tried again subsequently but never had another crop like the first one and gave up the effort. The wheat seed came from a seed dealer who said it had been cleaned. I'm sure it had, but cleaners can't get out every weed seed, and there were at least a few downy brome seeds in that 10 pounds he gave me. The experience taught me that if I ever try to grow wheat again, I should get seed from the Washington State Crop Improvement Association. It has also informed my understanding of the plight farmers find themselves in when confronted with weeds, let alone herbicide-resistant ones. I'm not a weed scientist, and I certainly don't play one on TV, but based on my reading of the situation, I think we might be at a tip-of-the-iceberg moment. That is, the problem with resistance that Northwest farmers are experiencing today is but a small part of what's looming below the waterline. But as you'll hear ahead, there is a back-to-the-future solution that doesn't rely on chemicals. In the near term, however, both Burke and Lyon expect tillage to make a comeback, but it won't be the tillage of an earlier generation. I ask Lyon what kind of reception his ideas are getting among the direct seed farming community.
Well, I'll tell you, I just recently got an invitation to go speak at a conservation district meeting in eastern Klickitat County, and they specifically asked me about using tillage in direct seed systems. So they're at least thinking about it. And I understand their hesitancy. We certainly don't want to go back to the days where we tilled everything all the time and we had lots of erosion issues and maintaining water in the soil was more difficult. But if herbicides, and this is my thinking, herbicides are going to become less and less effective. We're not going to have a lot of new things coming. There'll be some, but it won't be like it has been. Then we need to look at what role tillage can play and how can we use it where we get the most weed control benefit out of it with the least amount of damage to the soil and soil quality. So I think that's an area that's ripe for research. And if you can't even talk about it, then I think we slow our progress. So I think growers, some direct seeders, it's absolutely, I'll never do this. Other direct seeders are saying, okay, I have this problem. How can I deal with it? And how can I deal in such a way to best handle my problem? But I'm really very strong. I have strong feelings about soil quality. I want to do as little damage as possible. So I think we're going to find that middle ground. And again, out of necessity, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'd add to that, tillage is a broad term. I don't think Drew and I are advocating for the use of the moldboard plow or wide acreage. I think the thoughtful incorporation of disturbance into a system would include something as simple as going from a virtually no disturbance drill to a high disturbance drill at planting in the spring. That could really have a big impact on weeds. We know that's a really good solution for rat-tail fescue management, for example. So I think there's an array of options available to producers. It could be something as simple as having a diversity of drills present in their operation and deploying the tillage at planting thoughtfully and creatively to manage weeds. We're not going to go moldboard plow the palouse.
Yeah. Yeah, and we tend to think in generalities, but every different weed has a different approach. You know, annual grasses, seed longevity is fairly short. Crop rotation is a great way to work on it. You could bury the seed, and then if you don't bring it back up for 6-7 years, it dies out fairly quickly. You do that with something like Mayweed Chamomile that has seed longevity of 20 years. You plow it. If you plow it in the next 15 years, you're just bringing that seed right back up. So plowing is not a very good answer for that. It might be. There's all these little intricacies, and we don't, you know, when we say tillage, there's a whole range of tillage, and it depends on what your issue is, you know, how you use it, when you use it. My hope is that it's used very seldom, but when it's used wisely and with good purpose.
So I had a question here in which I was going to ask you how many species of weeds in the Pacific Northwest are resistant and to what chemicals, but I'm feeling that that would just take 5 minutes of the podcast here for you to list all of those.
Yeah. Ian's been doing the testing and he's said the numbers keep growing.
It's a long list and I'm not sure that I can remember all the details.
What is the most important weed that is resistant at this point?
For me, I would say there are two, Italian ryegrass and downy brome. In the different rainfall zones, they're each their own sort of special pest. Downy brome is the consummate avoider of all we throw at it. It has the ability to germinate after we plant and set seed before we spray it. And even when we try and spray it, it's pretty clear that it has the ability to evolve resistance. Italian ryegrass has sort of the same attributes, except ryegrass is a little different. Downy brome selfs itself. So when it pollinates, it's only pollinating that plant. Italian ryegrass is what we call an outcrosser. So it pollinates all its neighbors around it and potentially neighbors in someone else's field, right? So it can move, the resistance can move a little bit more rapidly through a population. So one person can select for a kind of resistance that can spread fairly rapidly in ryegrass. Typically, when we see downy brome evolving resistance, it usually sticks to the farm it's in. It might spread throughout the farm. It might maybe cross a fence row, but it's not going to spread as widely or as rapidly as the resistance we see in ryegrass.
What about something like Russian thistle? I mean, you know, it tumbles. So does that mean that it can go on the next neighbor's farm?
It is. Yeah, that's everyone's problem once someone selects for resistance in Russian thistle. You know, there's some great pictures of the paths that Russian thistle and kochia leave as they cross fields and are resistant to inputs. The grower then goes in and sprays a fallow field and there's this beautiful row of survivors out there that follow the tumble path. Yeah, that's once one person selects for resistance, that weed, Russian thistle, has the ability to spread that resistance throughout the region very quickly.
I think Don Till, been several decades ago, but he...
And he's the University of Idaho agronomist or weed scientist.
Retired now, but okay. did a lot of great work in this area. But he spray painted some tumbleweeds and then followed them. And I think they came up with... They move about an average of a little over a mile. Within a mile, it usually finds a dead airspace or it gets trapped on a fence or something. But they do move.
Mm-hmm. And then the next year, yep, the seedlings germinate and they tumble away from that fence row into the next one.
Scientists are stacking traits in GMO crops, meaning that they have more than one attribute which has been engineered in. But weeds are also stacking traits. In Indiana, there are weeds that are resistant to 7 herbicide modes of action. Is this outcome representative of poor farming, or is it just a matter of time before we in the Northwest experience something similar?
It's not a representative of poor farming. It's an attribute of the marketplace. It's an attribute of the price point herbicides are set at. And so growers face tremendous economic constraints They have my utmost respect for the job they do. Sometimes I don't know how they keep up with all the decisions they have to make. Some of the hardest decisions to make are where to stop spending money on things like herbicides, because they're often the most expensive thing that growers buy, right there next to the nitrogen bill. And so the price point of the herbicides are set on what the market will bear, what the growers perceive to be willing to pay for it, and not set on the long-term sustainability of the input. There's a growing body of evidence that seems to indicate that mixing herbicides have different modes of action that are both active on the same weed, that are complementary in their action, is a critical resistance management input for the sustainability of both of the herbicides in question. But the herbicides themselves are not priced to facilitate that. And so what happened to get seven kinds of resistances in the same plant is that one technology was introduced, the plant evolved resistance to that, and then the next one, and it was a conveyor belt. And so at the end of the conveyor belt is a weed with resistance to seven modes of action.
Is this something that is caused by these multinational companies we were talking about earlier?
It's difficult to throw any one entity or group under the bus. We're all in this together. I would say that it's a symptom of the system we live in. You don't want to throw capitalism under the bus either, because we certainly have been beneficiaries of that. But I have to think that that's played a major role in the decisions we have made to deploy these herbicides singly and allow them to fail, and then to choose to deploy the next herbicide by itself and allow it to fail.
It's also some of human nature, right? When I find something that works for me, I tend to stick with it until it doesn't work for me anymore. And that's what growers, they find a product that works for them. They like it. They don't see any reason to switch up. And so they stick with it until they've made it not work very well. And then they go find the next thing that works for them. It's hard to tell somebody, this is working, now go do something different or else this one won't be working. So it's human nature. It's the way our industry is set up. It's the marketplace. Lots of different factors. That's why herbicide resistance is called a wicked problem, because there is no simple solution, because it's more than just the chemistry. It's more than just the marketing. It's more than just human nature. It's all these things interacting together.
I've got the title for my podcast now, The Wicked Problem. What about we talked about tank mixing chemicals. What about using pre-plant herbicides as a way to diversify herbicide modes of action? What are the pros and cons?
Do you mean pre-emergence?
Right.
That's, with glyphosate-resistant kochia, that's been a major strategy in the Great Plains region, is to go to the soil-applied pre-emergence herbicides. It brings a different set of mode of actions, generally speaking, different than what we use when we spray post-emergence. A lot of these soil applies control for an extended period of time. We've started some work in the fallow areas trying to look at some soil applieds to address the glyphosate-resistant Russian thistle issue we have. So I think it's a good strategy, but again, it's a herbicide, so you have all those issues tied with herbicides. You don't want to stick with just one. You want to make sure you mix up, and that if you have a combination is to put a pre down and follow it up with an effective post and give it a 1-2 punch with different mechanisms of action. So we don't want to rely just on pre-emergence, or we'll get ourselves in the same trouble we're in with a lot of our post-emergence products.
The way that resistance works is that, certain weeds have a resistance to the chemical in their genetic makeup. Is there a diversity within the species? For instance, Russian thistle. Is Russian thistle all the same plant, or is the Russian thistle down in Columbia County different from the Russian thistle that is up in Adams County?
I had a grad student, Ian and I both advised John Spring, now with Colorado State University, and he did a project where he drove around eastern Washington, northeast Oregon, and collected Russian thistle, and then did some genetic testing of it and some spraying. And his findings would suggest that it's just a very diverse population. There was no patchiness to it. So it was just this big mob of genetic diversity, which actually makes it more likely to develop resistance, right? You have this huge genetic diversity. Somebody, some entity in that huge genetic population is going to have that gene for resistance. And if you keep applying the same selection pressure over again, you're going to select it. So, but it varies. You know, sometimes there are different populations. I think a lot of Ian's work with Downy Brome has, you have more different populations, distinct populations. So again, it comes back to every situation's a little different. Every weed's a little different because its genetics are different. Its reproduction is different.
So you have a program at WSU to test for resistant weeds. How many submissions have you had and are they growing?
We have over 200, I believe. It seems like some years are better than others for samples that we get in, but it's never less than 30 or so. I used to think that was a low number, and in discussions I've had with some of my counterparts in Australia, that's actually okay for a sort of voluntary program. That some of the programs in Australia get 200 to 300 a year, sometimes more. Our capacity to test that number of samples would be difficult, but you know, we try and turn those around as quickly as possible, but 30 to 50 is a nice number to get. And it's usually a mixture of growers and field managers that are sending those samples in.
Okay. So tell farmers here now how they would send in samples to test for resistance.
It's really easy, although it can be annoying to stop the combine. The easiest way to do it is just have a few fistfuls of coin envelopes in the cab.
Coin envelopes.
It doesn't have to be a lot of seed. I only need a few hundred seed to test. And then, you know, make a note of the GPS coordinate and what you think that plant is on the coin envelope. And I'll really only need a fistful of seed. Box them up and send them to me as you have time. It does take often 9 months to 12 months for us to test all of these samples. But knowledge is power. And we've found some interesting things for some of the producers who have sent their samples in this way, things that might still work, which is a powerful bit of information to have rather than sort of taking a stab in the dark on embedding a herbicide on an entire field. The address to send the samples is found on the Small Grains website. We have a little weeds link there on the Small Grains website for the herbicide resistance testing program, and it's easy to send that in. And we'll get back with the grower if they send an email address almost immediately upon receipt.
Great. Wonderful. Would the addition of winter peas in the summer fallow area help with weed resistance, or would it hurt?
So you kind of have, in my opinion, you have to back up and let's just talk about weed management. We face a real decision here in the next decade, in my opinion. We're facing a declining number of new herbicides. We're seeing many of our most useful herbicides become obsolete for the weeds we're trying to manage because of resistance. And so we might have to come to terms with eradicating weeds and what that might cost to really make these systems long-term sustainable. So winter pea, as a diversification of our cropping system, represents a step in the right direction, in my opinion, for breaking some of these species that we're trying to manage, actually reducing the numbers over time so that even if they are present, they're in such low numbers we don't see them anymore, particularly grass species. In general, we see a broadleaf introduced into a system dominated by a grass crop. The broadleaf crop tends to help reduce grass weed problems. So it's not just about the herbicides either, because the winter pea is competitive and it creates a different environment altogether than what winter wheat would. The inputs are different. The herbicides are different. How you manage weeds is different enough that it represents a step forward in the mitigation of weeds as a problem.
I'm a big fan of crop rotation. I did a lot of my early work in Nebraska on crop rotations, both for weed control and to make no-till systems work better. To me, that's if you're going to get rid of our tillage, you need to have a really good crop rotation. So where our systems, cropping systems in eastern Washington are very wheat-centric, and I think that's led to some of the herbicide issues we have. So introducing peas, canola, crops with different growth habits, different times of seeding, all that stuff is really helpful It's nice when you can also make a profit at it. So that's the
that's key.
That's the biggest challenge.
Yeah, that's actually the biggest challenge. So getting a crop that maybe it won't be as profitable as another crop, but you're not losing money on it. Winter peas, winter canola, just like spring peas and spring canola here in the high rainfall. Diversity is very helpful for breaking weed cycles, pest cycle, disease cycles. Helps in a lot of different ways. So I don't see any real negatives to bringing that in as long as you can make a little money on it at some point.
Wonderful. So now you two both have PhDs and years of experience working with herbicides. How is a farmer who is juggling a dozen balls supposed to stay on top of which chemical works, which can be tank mixed, which weeds are susceptible, and which chemical groups each herbicide is?
That's a good question. And they need decision support tools. And, Drew and I have come up with some what I would call rudimentary tools to aid in their decision-making process. You know, the very first thing that became obvious to me when I arrived in the PNW was just this incredible number of generic products we have. They change every year. The names change. But it turns out we only have a very limited number of what I would call active ingredients, the actual herbicides. We're just mixing them together in different ratios and attaching a new trade name to them and selling them. So that really presents an impediment to growers making good informed decisions. So we've got a nice tool on the Small Grains website that growers can put that trade name in and it'll spit out the active ingredients and the mode of action with it. So they can maybe make a little bit quicker work of figuring out exactly what a recommendation is and what they're doing rather than just sort of sitting on a trade name and thinking, well, that worked well and not really necessarily understanding. I encourage all growers to think critically about that over the winter and not necessarily in the heat of the spring decision-making press. So that's sort of the careful planning that needs to go in, a careful understanding that needs to be given to making some of these herbicide decisions. That happens when there's snow on the ground.
The latest suggestion I've seen in terms of dealing with weed resistance is squadrons of little robots out there who work 24 hours a day, either zapping weeds or somehow pulling them out of the ground. Is that the future? What is the future?
That's the future. I'm not sure that the technology is going to be affordable to a grain producer with a sizable amount of acreage initially, but certainly we're going to see a lot of the very high value crops in the irrigated areas in Washington begin to use robots as part of their weed management system. And once the technology becomes less expensive, I anticipate seeing robots become deployed. And it doesn't necessarily have to be an unattended machine out in the field doing its own thing, right? So we have a really nice technology available to our producers now, sold by two different companies. John Deere sells something called a Weed Seeker, and there's a available system called the Weed It, a Weed IT, and both of them involve sensors that detect weeds in a fallow system and automatically activate the spray nozzle to spray them. Well, that's an incredible reduction in total pesticide load on an acre basis, and that sort of technology is available now. I anticipate seeing technology becoming more integral in the weed management systems that we deploy in the PNW. Beyond just the typical broadcast of herbicides or deployment of tillage with a tractor, I think we're going to see some really creative and innovative mechanisms deployed in the coming decade.
And it might not, the early ones might be go out and find and spray a herbicide, but I know there's people working on lasers. Again, it's going to depend on the crop. It's going to depend on the weed species, how long it takes the robot to go through that area. So it might be a combination, right? We know the first germinating weeds that come up with the crop are the most competitive. There we might need some broad acre, typical herbicide thing. But after that, those later weeds that we just try to keep from setting seed, maybe it's not critical that we get to them. And then you can release some robots to go out there and take care of those before the seed is set. And they work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's probably an integration of those things. And I'm sure there are things that none of us here have thought about yet that will come along and possibly be of use in fighting weeds. People have been fighting weeds since man has been doing agriculture, so I don't see that changing.
It's amazing to think what robotics might bring to agriculture in the future. Could it be that the ag chemical revolution that began in the 1950s and continues today will one day be seen as a blip, a temporary deviation that helped agriculture feed the planet as it moved from tillage to robotic roguing? I hope you enjoyed episode 132, or what I entitled, The Wicked Problem of Herbicide Weed Resistance. The second part of my conversation with weed scientists Ian Burke and Drew Lyon. Please join me again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.